We're in the fifth session of a series, as it was in the days of Noah. And we're drawing, hopefully, we're trying to clarify some things with regard to the culture in which we live. And at the very least, I think that we're living in a culture that is experiencing the Romans 1 phenomena of God giving over a culture. We talked about that last time in the area of sexuality. I want to talk about another subject that has had an enormous effect on our culture, a hot button for lots of emotion, and has sort of marked our culture, at least since the Supreme Court decision. I want to talk about abortion. And I want to talk about it from the point of view, first of all, of an historic overview of the subject matter. And then I want to talk about the medical perspective and then the scriptural perspective. I think that a lot of Christians believe that abortion is an American issue that reared its head in the 1970s. And that's what abortion is. That couldn't be further from the truth. Abortion's not an American issue. It's a human issue. It's not even a modern issue at all. When you think about in the United States that since the 1970s, the Roe v. Wade decision, depending on who you read, but there's been slightly more than 56 million abortions. So when you think of the number 56 million, the number seems staggering to us. It has to, right? I mean, you're thinking 56 million. Well, in that same period of time, worldwide, there have been 1.7 billion abortions. 1.7 billion abortions. Now, if you take out, let's just say not one person had an abortion in America, not one, then worldwide you'd have 1.65 billion instead of 1.7 billion. So it's certainly not an American issue only. It's also not a current issue. The first era of sort of abortion on demand and infanticide in Western culture occurred under the Greeks. So you're going around 400 to 500 BC. Plato and Aristotle become the key players. In Plato's Republic, he writes that abortion or infanticide should become obligatory if the woman is 40 years of age or older. They should have an abortion or infanticide. The Greeks are real clear when they write about what we would call the baby or the fetus. Their view is that the welfare of society and the welfare of a family are far above the rights of an unborn child. Does that sound at all old? It sounds just like now. Solomon's view, there's sort of nothing new under the sun. Aristotle had an enormous effect on Western civilization when it comes to this whole idea of human life. When does it begin? Of all people, he had an enormous effect on the church as well. Aristotle believed that that a fetus, I'll use that term right now, a fetus becomes a baby for a male at 40 days. At 40 days, the fetus becomes a male baby. At 80 days, the fetus becomes a female baby. That's kind of interesting, to say the least. The style of abortion in ancient times, it's kind of an interesting thing. This isn't in all cases, but one of the prevailing methods of abortion was that, especially among the Greeks, the woman drinks poison. And you drink just enough poison to kill the fetus, but not you. Now, I don't know if that was trial and error. I don't know how they did that. But apparently, they figured out a way in which to do it. And again, it's very common. Christianity changes everything in the Roman Empire when Christianity shows up. The Romans did practice abortion, but much more likely to practice infanticide. The Romans' view was that the man of the house decides. And so whenever a baby was born, the man of the house decided if he wanted the baby or to kill the baby. Normally by abandonment, normally at the city dump. If it was a female, the chances are far, far greater that the baby would be put on the dump. If it was a male and had any kind of noticeable deformity, immediately put on the dump. Now, one of the things that even Seneca writes about that I find interesting, the Roman writer, is that Christians in different Roman cities around the province would show up at the city dump, watch when the babies were abandoned, grab the babies, and raise them for themselves. And the Romans just couldn't understand that. So even in the context of the early church, you see this idea of the sanctity of life being something that's come into play even among those in the early church. The first time you see things in writing in the early church is about AD 100. Now remember, John's writing the book of Revelation and 1st, 2nd, 3rd John, sometimes around 90 to 91, 92, right in that period of time. The Didache was written in AD 100. And in the Didache, it says this, early church fathers wrote it, "You shall not kill the fetus by abortion or destroy the infant already born." So they make a reaction against both abortion and infanticide in AD 100. And then it about the middle of that next century, there's an epistle, extra-biblical epistle, called the Epistle of Barnabas. And that epistle says that abortion qualifies as murder. And so that's the first time in the early church in writing you see someone actually writing in the Epistle of Barnabas that the church viewed as abortion was murder. That was held by many of the church fathers, Tertullian and Clement of Alexandria, Hippolytus, Cyprian. All of those agreed that with the Didache and with the Epistle of Barnabas. And then Origen came on the scene. And Origen is a very intellectual man. And he was trained by the Greeks before he came to Christ. And he was very influenced by Aristotelian logic. He had great admiration for Aristotle. And Origen decides that there has to be a distinction between the unborn and the born. So he's the first guy that really sets that in place in the church. There has to be a distinction between the unborn and the born. Jerome agreed, and he's kind of a big player. And then a very big player got involved, Augustine of Hippo. So St. Augustine of Hippo, one of the great early Christian thinkers, he got involved, and they all agreed with Origen, which is kind of an interesting thing. Augustine's view was that prior to the forming of the baby, if you aborted it, it was immoral, but not murder. So there's a distinction in the early church. That was continued all the way through to Thomas Aquinas, who also bought that perspective. Now, this may come as a surprise to you. That idea of the distinction idea of immoral, but until the baby's formed, it's not murder. That was the position of the Roman Catholic Church until the mid-19th century. So that's an interesting perspective. To the mid-19th century, the mid-1800s, that was the position of the Roman Church. A man named S. Gordon Melton wrote a really good book on the history of abortion, and one of the things that he said is he examined why did the Catholic Church change its position in the 19th century. And he said there was two reasons in the mid-19th century. One, they finally had a much better understanding of the fertilization process. They understood development a much better way in the mid-1800s than they had, obviously, for all those centuries before. And that makes some sense. Two, though, is a little bit unusual. His perspective is the other reason they changed their position was, you remember, it's in the mid-19th century that the Roman Church decides to set up as church dogma the dogma of the Immaculate Conception. Now, please understand and don't make the mistake. I'm sure many of you who grew up Catholic really understood it. You just never talked to me. Because every single Roman Catholic that I have talked to just casually said to them over all these years, what is the doctrine of the Immaculate Conception? Without exclusion, everyone who has talked to me said, that's the belief in the teaching that Jesus was immaculately conceived. And I said, that's not true. Everybody believes Jesus was immaculately conceived. It's as clear in the book of Luke as it could possibly be. The church fathers, everybody believes that Jesus was immaculately conceived. That's not the doctrine of the Immaculate Conception. The doctrine of the Immaculate Conception is that Mary was immaculately conceived. That's the doctrine of the Immaculate Conception. Now, you can see what the problem is. Mary's immaculately conceived, so the idea of Mary at conception being unique and distinct happened at conception. So you can't say Mary was nothing until she was formed, because she was immaculately conceived. And so the church changed its position. Now, interesting, as a parallel to that, since the 1500s, the reformers, Luther, Calvin, Zwingli, all those, later that followed like Knox and Wesley, they all had the same position. Their position was this. They viewed abortion as murder. So the Protestants viewed abortion as murder right from the get-go. Now remember, they only drew their conclusion, though, from Scripture. They really didn't draw their conclusion from the culture, the way the culture saw things. And so in the 1800s, they began to try to figure out when would be it appropriate and when. I was just talking to a couple before the service, and in the 1800s, they started saying things like, the baby could be aborted as long as the mother hadn't felt a quickening. In other words, if you haven't felt the baby move yet or the quickening, then you could have, legally, you could, in a sense, you can get an abortion. Now, once you feel the quickening, you can't do that. You see, they're struggling with this idea of when it becomes a person. In the 1840s, there was a lot of advancement in the ability to medically perform an abortion. Much more so than it was before. You weren't poisoning the mother, just hoping for the best and that kind of thing. That became so rampant in our country, in the United States, that the birth rate in the mid-19th century went from 7 children per family to 3.5 per family. Now think of that. The birth rate immediately is cut in half. And by the late 1800s, and this is according to Ken Boa, and if you ever want to read Ken Boa, you can, B-O-A, just like a boa constrictor. Anything you want to read of his, read it. Very, very bright Christian teacher. I found an article, I think, in Bible.org about this. He covers some of the history. But he said by the late 1800s in the United States, 1 out of 5 babies were aborted. Now, that's the late 1800s. 1 out of 5 babies were aborted. In fact, the statistic he came up with that he had found was this. There were 160,000 abortions in the late 1800s for 27 million people. There were 27 million people in the country, and there were 160,000 abortions. If you do the math, by the way, it's a little bit above the rate today. And we have 310 million. It's an interesting thought because, see, I think a lot of times we believe, well, none of this existed to this Roe v. Wade thing. I mean, that just was what when they started doing it. Not true. Been going on for some time. In the late 1800s, a great opposition in our country arose against abortion. And there were two groups that aligned themselves together against abortion. The AMA, which is kind of interesting, the American Medical Association, aligned themselves against abortion. But this one will be the surprise. And the feminist movement. The AMA and the feminist movement. Now, I find that really interesting. Sarah Foster, the feminist case against abortion in her work. This is what she writes. Without known exception, the early American feminists condemned abortion in the strongest possible terms. In Susan B. Anthony's newsletter, The Revolution, abortion was described as child murder, infanticide, and I guess it's foeticide. Also, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who in 1848 organized the first women's rights convention in Seneca Falls, New York, classified abortion as a form of infanticide and said, when you consider that women have been treated as property, It is degrading to women that we should treat our children as property to be disposed of as they see fit. You see, why did the feminists go up in uproar? Why would the feminist? Because at that stage, and throughout most of the history of abortion, by the way, it was male-dominated. Men got women to have abortions to cover their tracks. So that's why women had abortions, and that's why the feminists came out and said, we're against this. Now, you can see our culture has shifted a lot in 100 years. Now, it's very much a feminist issue. In the first half of the 20th century, and we're moving along, okay. In the first half of the 20th century, something happened in the development of contraceptives. They started making contraceptives, and they found out a way to prevent pregnancy in a much better way. And so this whole idea of contraceptive development changed everything, but not in the way that you might think. The leading advocates of contraception were influenced at that time by something called eugenics. That was the buzzword. Eugenics. Eu means good. And genics means birth or born. Good births, good born. He said, what would that possibly mean? Well, I'll tell you what it means. Contraceptives need to be given to people who aren't good in our eyes. And people who are good, they should be having children. But people who aren't good should not be having children. Now, let me translate that. People who are white, middle class, and upper class should have children. And people who are not white, or white and not middle class or upper class, should not have children. They should have contraception. Here's the quote of the year for that. This is a quote from Margaret Sanger. Now, who is she? The founder of Planned Parenthood. She's a key figure here. Margaret Sanger, quote, "We need more children from the fit and less from the unfit. That's the chief issue when it comes to birth control." I don't know, but I think Adolf Hitler picked right up on that. I think maybe he had a different definition of fit than she did, but it was the same idea. Abortion picked up again in our culture in the 1960s. And one of the reasons it did was in the 1960s, we talked about this last time, was sort of the beginning of the sexual revolution. And abortion became a very important element. And the idea behind it was this, that women should be allowed to be part of the sexual revolution without being forced to accept the consequences of it. So women should be able to have abortions. And now you see a shift. And the shift becomes down to what is best for the individual person. It's not about family or culture or anything like that. That's when it really shifted. In 1970, Jane Roe, really her name's Norma McCorvey, challenged the constitutionality of the Texas law. And it went by 1973 to the Supreme Court, Roe v. Wade. And we know, I think it was a 7-2, the justices came down on that side. I think it was a 7-2 ruling. But what's interesting about it is if you read about her, apparently later she became a Christian and then really regretted the issue. But one of the things she most regretted was, in order to make her case stronger, both at the Texas level and the Supreme Court level, she claimed that her pregnancy was due to being raped. She later, after the ruling, said, "I was not raped." Now, the idea of rape is a very big element in something like this. But the perspective of it, that's when everything legally changed in the United States. So, having said that much, I want to talk a little bit now about something else that sort of brought us up to date here. All right. Now, I want to talk about the current debate and the problems that we have. And I'm going to make it in two phases. In the initial stages of this debate in the 1970s, 80s, probably into the 90s, but the 70s and 80s in particular, the Planned Parenthood debate had a certain perspective. These are the premises they went by. One, it's not a baby. It's a fetus. Now, that's not new, as you find. That goes all the way back to Aristotle, goes all the way back. I mean, that when is it a baby? It's not a baby, it's a fetus. The key impact is that this pregnancy is really bad for a woman. It could be bad for her health. It could be bad for her emotions. It could be bad for her career, her future. There's a lot of that rhetoric. But it's not a baby, it's a fetus. Number two, an unwanted pregnancy puts a woman at risk. And if you remember the debate, you hear this all the time. You're putting women at risk. If you look at the numbers, by the way, on women at risk in pregnancy, it's extremely small. If you look at the number of women in the idea of abortion out of rape, incest, and other, the percentages are so microscopic of the whole issue. But that became a very important premise to them. And that was unwanted pregnancy puts women at risk. And the focus was on older women and incest and rape. The third one was this. The woman is much more important than the fetus. There's a great distinction, this is Planned Parenthood's perspective, between a who and a what. So that's kind of an interesting, that's how they framed it. And from that point of view, if the fetus is a mass of tissue, like an appendix or a wisdom tooth, and the removal of the unwanted tissue by the woman, if she decides she wants that unwanted tissue removed, it makes perfect sense to do it. That was kind of the early debate. The pro-life debate had been from the beginning this. Life begins at conception. Life is called, it's either called a pre-born baby or a baby. The second premise is this. Unborn babies are fully human, and as fully human, they have to be protected, especially from the idea of any attack from the inside or the outside. If the fetus is a pre-born human being, then it has to be protected at all cost. And that was then, but that's not now. If you start reading now, though, in the last, say, 15, 20 years, the literature from Planned Parenthood, it's a little bit different. They've dropped the word. Fetus. They don't talk about that anymore. And the reason is medical science has kind of caught up to it. And so you have a struggle calling it the fetus. And so, for example, in one of their publications, here's what they write now as sort of the argument. We all have many important decisions to make in life. What to do about an unplanned pregnancy is an important and common decision faced by women. Notice it's an unplanned pregnancy and now you have a decision to make. In fact, about half of all women in the United States will have an unplanned pregnancy at some time in their life. Now, that seems like an enormous amount, but on the other hand, anybody that's ever had a family, a lot of times a baby comes and isn't planned. It's not that the family's upset because the baby's coming, it's just the baby wasn't planned and now the baby's coming. But they make that part of the 50%. They said also, about a 4 out of 10 women with an unplanned pregnancy will decide to have an abortion. Overall, more than 1 out of 3 of all U.S. women will have an abortion by the time they're 45 years old. Now, that's their talk. Now, when they speak about the baby now, they talk about it as a pre-born baby, not a fetus anymore. But now they write things like this. This is the new normal. It is a pre-born baby, and that's unfortunate. We wish there weren't so many abortions, but for very specific reasons, we need to keep the real option open for women. The central issue in abortion is simply a matter of timing, viability, and what method to use. In other words, it now becomes a decision of what the woman feels is best for her life. Now, before, remember, that they got this passed, and in the early stages, it's not a baby. So don't get all riled up. It's just a fetus. It's just a mass of tissue. Now, they ignored a lot of things like 46 chromosomes, and it's male, you know, it's uniquely different than they are, completely different than they are, completely different than anyone who ever lives. This is a unique human being. The baby can have a blood type that's not even the mother's blood type. You know, the whole idea that this is just like an appendix is really ill-conceived, but they don't say that anymore. The Guttmacher Institute, which is an international authority on abortion research founded by a wing of Planned Parenthood, they say this. The reasons that women give for having abortion underscore their understanding of their responsibilities of how they see parenthood and family life. Now, remember, now this is pro Planned Parenthood. The reason that a woman can have should have an abortion is, how does she see family and how does she see family in parenthood? And if she sees that I don't want my family, I'm not ready for parenthood, then there you go. That's a different argument than the argument that it's not a human being. You see, and it's changed. Surveys that were done, 3 out of 4 women in the United States who have had an abortion say that their main reason was they weren't ready to care for another person. That was 3 out of 4. 3 out of 5 said they can't afford another child. And 2 out of 3 said that it would interfere with work and or career. Those are interesting reasons. So you see how this whole thing is just kind of, the whole dialogue of the whole thing is kind of changed. Now, the pro-life position hasn't changed at all. It's exactly the same as it's been. The argument that the Planned Parenthood uses, that the impact on the mother's mental and physical health or welfare has not been shown to be that viable. But some things have been shown, and this is where the medical part comes in. The heartbeat begins between the 18th and 24th day after conception. So you have a heartbeat at the 18th to 24th day after conception. Brain waves have been recorded as early as 45 days after conception. So now you have brain waves. That's 45 days. The mother can feel physical movements as early as 42 days. That's why I was fishing earlier for when you felt the baby. At 8 weeks, the baby possesses unique fingerprints that it will have for life. At 8 weeks. All bodily functions are present at 8 weeks and are functioning at 11 weeks. That's really interesting. All this has kind of changed. At 11 to 12 weeks, the baby begins to suck its own thumb. So you're not very far along. You're 11 or 12 weeks. And that happens. Now, I want you to think about it. This is something I find more unique than almost anything else. I hope I can convey it. The criteria for death, as established by the Harvard Medical School. What is the criteria for death? This is the criteria. Harvard Medical School. The criteria for a person being dead is, 1, no response to external stimuli or pain. That's the first criteria. No response to external stimuli or pain. 2, no spontaneous movements or respiratory efforts. That's 2. 3, no deep reflexes. 4, no brain activity, as indicated by EEG. Now, when you have those in play, the Harvard Medical School says that person is dead. Okay? Now, why is that so important? Okay. Now, if you reverse the criteria, what must you be indicating? A person is alive. And this is interesting. It says, if the reverse or even one of the above criteria occurred, the fetus would be considered alive. At 8 to 11 weeks, they all occur. So what we say makes a person dead, at 11 weeks, the fetus has all of them, establishing that the fetus is alive. It would seem of all the different ways we try to approach this thing legally, especially with the courts or the Supreme Court, it would seem the medical argument like this would be the strongest argument. In the sense of what is, if this is death, then what is life? You know, what is exactly is life? This kind of evidence has become so profound and so clear now across the board that Protestants and Catholics and Jews and Muslims, we now have a new ally in the pro-life group. I don't know if you realize this, but there are many now who have joined us and, they're known as atheists. Atheists are becoming pro-life, which I find as uniquely puzzling to me as anything could possibly be. But Elizabeth Cornwell is the executive director of the Richard Dawkins Foundation. Richard Dawkins about this famous, an atheist is a risen America. You know, you want to say atheist, he's the guy. He's the poster child. She's the ex-executive director. As an avowed atheist, Dawkins and his followers have claimed to have greater freedom in living than those who are bound by religious limitations. Curiously, though, they have taken the anti-abortion stand. Elizabeth Cornwell is quoted as saying this, "There's a war on the womb. As a secular pro-lifer, I believe my case is scientifically and philosophically sound. Science concedes that human life begins at fertilization, and it follows that abortion is ageism and discrimination against a member of our own species." Now, that's kind of an interesting thing. There's no religious argument here. There's the atheistic argument. Christopher Hitchens, who's another profound atheist, was asked, "Are you pro-life?" He said, "Yes, emphatically. Let me say it again, yes. And I repeatedly will always use the term unborn child against those on the left who say an aborted fetus is nothing more than a growth or an appendix or a polyp. Unborn child seems to me to be the real concept. It's not a growth. It's a human being." So that's kind of an interesting thing coming from a completely different point of view. Okay. I hope that's somewhat helpful to you in the sense of understanding the issue. Now, a little bit of the sadder part. 65% of women in the United States who have abortions, 65%, self-identify themselves as Christians. 65% self-identify themselves as Christians. 35% identify themselves as Protestants. And 28% identify themselves as Catholic. So this is self-identification. This, I don't know who knows the Lord, I'm not dealing with that. That's just what was talked about. 70% of all abortions occur with women under the age of 30. Okay? So what I want to do now is I want to look at a biblical record for a little bit here. And I want to begin in Genesis chapter 1. Genesis chapter 1. Genesis 1, verse 27. Famous verse. Now, it says, "And God created man." And this isn't just a man. This is the word Adam. He later is known as Adam, but Adam. This is mankind, and you'll see it's mankind by the context. "And God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them." Okay, so it's male and female, mankind. Now, the reason that's so important is twofold. One, man is created by God. That's what the scripture says. He's created by God. That gives him a worth. That gives man a worth that would have to be surreal. I mean, if I had a t-shirt, just a regular t-shirt, all right? And I said, how do you think, how much worth do you have on this? You might, I don't know, $10, $8. Now, but I have a polo player on it. Now what's it worth? Or I have a Nike swish on it. Now tell me, what's it worth now? Why is that? It's a t-shirt. No. That's polo. You see, that's Nike. Now, I could do something, and regrettably in my past I've done some unusual artwork, and I could do something and paint an abstract. Okay, and say, look at this. What do you think this is worth? Now that case you'd probably know emphatically. Not worth the paint that's on the canvas, all right? It's not worth that. But what if I said, it's a Picasso? Now what's it worth? Millions. Wait, just look, it's Picasso. You see how worth is established? God. God did this. God. You see how important this is? God created man. God created man. The worth that man has, the intrinsic worth that man has, because God created man. And it even gets better, because he says, in his own image. Wow. You see, that gives man, there is such a dignity to human life. Now, hey, the animal world's a wonderful world, but it's not that world. You see, those are an animal world. They're not in God's image. We're in God's image. You see, this is a very important aspect of this whole thing. Now, let me show you how this plays out. Let's go to Genesis chapter 9. We're after the flood. And in verse 7 of chapter 9, we read this before, looked at this before. God says, and as for you, be fruitful and multiply, populate the earth abundantly and multiply in it. We talked about that under sexuality, part of that discussion. But I want to look at the verse before it, verse 6. Whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed. Now, this is established long before Moses is given the law, long before thou shalt not murder. This is way before then. Why? Look at the next part of verse 6. For in the image of God he made them. You see, why is that a capital offense? Man is made in the image of God. You see, there's such a dignity to man, don't you? There's no prohibition. You don't get this kind of prohibition because you kill an animal. But you certainly get this when you kill a man. Man is made in God's image. That's his point. Whoever sheds a man's blood, by man, his blood shall be shed. For he is in the image that he says, God, he made man. That's the point. That's why this is such an enormous issue. An absolutely enormous issue. Now, there's another aspect about the value of man, not just this protection aspect. I want to look at, I guess right now I want to look at the most controversial verse in the English text. You'll find Exodus 21. Exodus 21. And by the way, this verse, Exodus, verse 22 of Exodus 21, is a verse that pro-choicers use and say the Bible supports abortion. It's amazing. But depending on the translation, you could see how it could become construed that way. If you have an RSV, Revised Standard Version, it's one of the worst. New American Standard's not that much better, a little bit. NIV is the best here. They do the best job of capturing what is being said here. Now, we'll look at these. Let me just read these two verses, 22 and 23. And if men struggle with each other and strike a woman with child so that she has a miscarriage, yet there is no further injury, he shall surely be fined as the woman's husband may demand of him, and he shall pay as the judges decide. But if there is any further injury, then you shall appoint as a penalty life for life. Now, what those who read that say that that passage is teaching is this. If two men are fighting and one of them hits the woman, hopefully not the husband, but the other hits the woman, and she miscarriages, then there's a fine to pay. But if she is injured or killed, if she dies, then it's life for life. That's how they read those two verses. And the RSV sort of lends itself that way. But the Hebrew doesn't lend itself that way in any sense of the word. Even the New American Standard, for example, when it says, and if men struggle with each other and strike a woman with child so that she has miscarried, and there is no further, you'll notice it's in italics. The word further is not even in the text. There is no word further in this text at all. None. And why they added further to think that would help the translation, it doesn't help the translation at all. It says, and notice in verse 23, but if there is injury, you know, and this is the term for grievous injury or death, then there'll be a life for life. So let me just run through a little bit about what happens here. What you see happening here is simply this. It says, if men struggle with each other and strike a woman with child. This part is good, the New American Standard. That's the word yelled. The only way the word yelled is ever translated in the Bible is child. Now, there's a lot of other words that can be used, by the way. The word golem is the word for embryo. We'll look at it in a few moments, or unformed substance. There is a word golem for that in Scripture. That's a different word. There's the idea of a miscarriage in Scripture, and that's a little bit different kind of word. It's the word nephel. This is not those words. This is the word for a child. If men struggle with each other and strike a woman with child, and she has, and there's the word miscarriage. Now, there is a word for miscarriage. But this isn't the word. In fact, if you turn to Exodus 23, verse 26. So we're not far from that. Just a simple statement. Verse 26 says, there shall be no one miscarrying or barren in your land. I will fulfill the number of your days. That word, there. Notice he says that there will be no one miscarrying. And that's the word meshakala for miscarriage. So Moses uses miscarriage in Exodus, but not back here in chapter 23, but back here in verse 21 that's translated in the New American Standard, miscarriage. It basically is the word yatsa, and it's the word coming out. It's the word that is used for birth. Let me explain it. Hold your place here and go with me back to Genesis chapter 25. Genesis chapter 25. Verse 24 of Genesis 25. When her days to be delivered were fulfilled, behold, there were twins in her womb. And it says, now the first came forth, Yatsa. The first was born. The first came out, red, all over like a hairy garment. Jacob and Esau. You see how this works. The first comes out. The word is always used for a birth. It is never used for a miscarriage in Scripture. New American Standard translating it to miscarriage is completely a wrong way of translating the verb. If men struggle with each other and strike the woman so that the child comes forth, is born. Notice, and there is no injury, he's still going to have to pay a fine for that. You see, he's going to have to pay a fine for that because it wasn't the natural time for the child to come forward. You induced the labor. Then he says after that, but if there is injury, and that word injury is grievous or fatal. Now, it's interesting. You can tell by the context it was that because then he says, then you shall appoint a penalty, a life for a life. If the baby lives and is fine, you pay a fine. If the baby dies, you die. You see, so that's a very different perspective. It's amazing that this is used by pro-choice people, but as long as you read it in a bad English version, I guess you can get away with it, and it works kind of that way. But I find it as an interesting idea that even back then God said, you don't do this. It certainly would apply to at least partial birth for sure. Now, I want to also then turn to Psalm 139. Psalm 139. If Psalm 139 is not one of your favorite psalms, then there's something wrong. You know, and the people in our country, you know, you hear this all the time, but, you know, what the prevailing problem of our country is that, you know, you get more empathy and sympathy from people when you basically, someone says, you know, the problem with that person, they have such low self-esteem. You know, and that's really the problem. They have such low self-esteem. Well, if you read Psalm 139, you can't have low self-esteem. If you believe it. I mean, that's the whole point. That's what David's overwhelmed with. So David starts out and he says, "Oh Lord," he said, "you have searched me and known me." He said, "you know when I sit down and when I rise up. You understand me," he says, "my thought from afar." He said, "you scrutinize my path and my lying down. You are intimately acquainted with all my ways." Now, you got to understand what David is, why David is saying this. It's not in the sense that you think. David is saying God's really smart and he knows everything. That's true. And David wouldn't deny it, but that's true. God is really smart and he does know everything. David's looking at it from a different point of view. Why would you, being God, be so intimate with me? You see, if you're God, I can't even imagine the ramifications of what it means to be God. I only know the little bit he's revealed to us. I know there's a physical creation. We call it a universe. I understand all that part. And then we're but I don't know what is the essence of all what God is. I have no idea. It's unfathomable to me. And David's sort of saying, but you want to be intimately acquainted with me. And that's kind of, he said, even before there was a word on my tongue, behold, O Lord, you knew it all. You have enclosed me from behind and before, laid your hand upon me. You've been in my life. I know it. I mean, think what David's been through. Goliath, Saul. I mean, the things that he's been through. He goes, you were right there with me this whole time. He said, such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It's too high. I can't attain it. He said, I'm giddy happy just thinking about it. I can't understand it. Why would you be that interested in me? You see, it's kind of an interesting thing. We struggle in our life because we look for somebody in this world who will be interested in us. Just another person who would be interested in us. David says, you're interested in me. And that bears itself through in all of the cases. Remember, what's he say to a person who is suffering the low esteem of being an orphan? He said, I'll be your father. Widow, I'll be your husband. You see? You have a need, I'll be there. I'm that interested in you. David says, I just don't get that. And then David says, you know, he says, where can I go from your spirit? Or where can I flee from your presence? He said, you know, if I ascend to heaven, there you are. If I make my bed in Sheol or the grave, behold, you're there. If I take the wings of dawn, or if I dwell at the remotest part of the sea, even there your hand will lead me. Your right hand will lay hold of me. If I say, surely the darkness will overwhelm me and the light around me will be night, even the darkness is not dark to you. And the night is as bright as day. Darkness and light are like alike to you. There's no escaping you. I don't know if you ever think about that. I tell people that's often when they first come to Christ or if I'm involved in the process. I say, look, you're going to have an option now in your life. You may never take God seriously. But I want to tell you something. He takes you very seriously. You see, he takes you very seriously. And so once you hook your wagon to him, you're hooked. You see, from his point of view, he's relentless in this. I'm never going to forsake you. I'm never going to leave you. I'm here. So you can say, no, I'm not really interested. And you can do that. But he won't. Then David says this. He said, for you did form my inward parts. He said, you did weave me in my mother's womb. This is kind of interesting. David is saying, you know what? Even before I was born, you were involved with me. The uniqueness of me. While I was in the womb, that's what I'm saying, from conception on, the 46 chromosomes. As far as I know, that's a unique feature. There never was anyone with the 46, with the arrangement of your chromosomes, there's never been anyone like that in the past. There'll never be another person like that in the future. You're unique. David's getting that from a little different perspective, but how amazing is that? He said, I will give thanks to you. What a great statement then. For I am fearfully, wonderfully made. That word fearfully means with the deepest respect. I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Now, if that doesn't spark a little self-esteem in you, No, some guy at work said I was a loser. And you know, he's always right. I mean, seriously, this is what God says. David says, I am fearfully and wonderfully made. And he says, now let me be clear about this. Wonderful are your works. What's he saying? I'm wonderful. I am created by you. I'm a work of God and wonderful your works, and that's me. You see, that's an amazing statement. Now, he goes on and then says, my soul knows it very well. What David is saying there, that's a spiritual, volitional reality to me. Boy, do I wish people thought that. See, I know that. We try so hard to be some other version of ourselves. Just so hard. Or we mimic some other person, want to be like them. And we're so unique on our own. He then says, my frame was not hidden from you when I was made in secret. That's kind of neat. Now, I understand this. This is kind of interesting. When I was conceived, you're right there. Right there when I was conceived. I never even gave that a thought. At that moment of conception, it would have been unknown to my parents. It would have been unknown to them. At that moment, God says, Bill. It's astounding. Nobody else, no, it's a secret to everybody else, but not to God. He goes, Bill, Sally, John. You see, that's what he is saying. He said, my frame was not hidden from you when I was made in secret and skillfully wrought in the depths of the earth. He said, your eyes have seen my unformed substance, golem, embryo. Your eyes saw my embryo. That's astounding. Now, please understand, the moment that God was intimately aware of me and God saw my embryo and he knew my frame, he knew everything about me. He even, watch what happens then. He says, and in your book they were written the days that were ordained for me. Isn't that amazing? At the moment of conception, God says, that's Bill. And I can tell you, I know exactly, I know what his frame is. I know exactly how many days he'll be here. All at the moment of the conception. You see, in some of us, it's a very short time. Some of us, it's a very long time. But God, he's saying, and the whole idea of it is, he's not just saying it because, well, of course God knows everything, so he knows how long everyone's going to be here. That's true. But that's not what David's saying. David is saying he has such a vested interest in me. You see, such an awareness of me. He is so intimate with me that his relationship with me began long before my relationship with him. You see, that's what David is saying. At the point of conception, he said, your eyes have seen my unformed substance. In the book they were written all the days that were ordained for me, when as yet there was not even one of them. So this is all happening where? In the womb. And it appears to be happening at what end of the pregnancy? The very beginning. And guess what? And guess what David calls the very beginning of the pregnancy? Me. Me. Not it. Me. You see, that becomes a very important element in all this. It's a me. Right from the beginning. That's one of the most unique and wonderful things.